Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dwayne Redford, and he'll be answering your most important questions on a systematic approach to nymphing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dwayne a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dwayne Redford about his systematic approach to nymphing. This segment of the show is brought to you by the Orvis Company, makers of fly rods in the USA since 1856 and still on the cutting edge with their award-winning Helos fly rods. Check out their premium quality flies like Copper Johns, Beadhead Princes, and Elk Hair Caddis for only $1.50 each at www.orvis.com/flies. That's www.orvis.com/flies. Fill your fly box this season at an incredible price. Find out more about all the great fly fishing products Orvis has at www.orvis.com. That's www.orvis.com. Before we introduce Dwayne, we'd like to let you know about some of the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawings tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dwayne's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Dwayne's book, The Fly Fisher's Playbook, A Systematic Approach to Nymph Fly Fishing. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something that Dwayne and I talk about during the show. And you've got to submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and maybe you'll win Dwayne's book. Tonight, our guest is Dwayne Redford. Dwayne is a professional fly fishing guide. He began fly fishing at the age of 10 and fueled his passion in the lakes and streams in the mountains of Arizona. He feels fortunate to have fished all over the Rocky Mountain West. As a retired public school teacher and coach, Dwayne finds that his passion for fly fishing and his enthusiasm for teaching work collaboratively in taking his clients to new heights. His first book on fly fishing, The Fly Fisher's Playbook, A Systematic Approach to Nymph Fly Fishing, was nearly 5 years in the making and born of necessity. Dwayne spends the majority of his days guiding for South Platte outfitters in the South Platte River below Deckers, Colorado. That stretch of river can be difficult to guide because of the constant changes in conditions. From changes in water flows and clarity, high angling, and recreation pressure, and a very diverse insect population, if you don't have a game plan, this river will humble you. Because of his coaching background, Dwayne has a knack for breaking things down systematically. He reads the trout defenses and adjusts accordingly with options and adjustments. Once you are able to incorporate fundamental nymphing skills with a systematic approach, you can begin to really enjoy the sport. Although the playbook was designed on the South Platte, works on any river. When he's not guiding, Dwayne spends his time teaching fly fishing classes and is currently producing a fly fishing DVD to accompany the book. When he's not teaching, filming, or guiding, you'll find him on the river. Well, Dwayne, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Well, I'm glad we could get you off the river here for a couple hours and tell us what you've been doing on the river.
Well, I've been real busy, thankfully, and we've been chasing fish up and down the South Platte below Deckers for the most part. So I can't say it's been fishing fantastic at this point. I mean, it's good. We're picking fish up in all the right spots, but we're still a little blown out here in Colorado. The water's dropping, you know, quickly, almost daily. So soon enough here, it's going to really turn on. So, yeah, I've been busy.
Yeah, we've had in Colorado record snowfall, I should say, all winter long, and we're still almost in spring runoff on Dwayne.
This is amazing. This is the farthest I've seen runoff ever.
Yeah, yeah. And I know it's actually hurt the fly fishing industry in Colorado because the rivers have been blown out for so long that it's hard to get out there and fish except for in some of the tailwaters. Like South Platte is a great place to still have clear water and be able to fish it.
And, yeah, and it's, you know, even at the high flows, you know, we're still picking up fish. So they still have to eat.
That's
part of that whole challenge, you know. You just have to figure them out. And for the most part, they push right over to the edges. So the good news is they're on the edges. The bad news is you are too.
So yeah.
You just have to, you know, rig up accordingly and fish it just systematically.
Yeah, systematically. So let's talk about that because that's what your book's all about and that's what your approach is with for yourself and for the people that you guide. I mentioned in your introduction a little bit about that, but why don't you kind of dig deeper into why you felt you needed to develop a systematic approach to nymphing?
Well, you know, and part of it is my nature, you know, as being an old coach. I feel that, you know, you build your successes off your fundamentals. You know, you start with your fundamentals. And those become your strengths. And at that point, you know, you can begin to branch out and use those fundamentals in pretty much every section of the river. So when I'm looking at a river as far as systematic approach, I have to read those defenses. You know, it's like a quarterback, you know, goes to the line of scrimmage with a base play in mind, and all of a sudden the defense, you know, shifts or does something else, or he reads that they're going to do something else. Well, you know, I approach the river the same way. I have to look at that with a base play in mind, but then I have to make adjustments, sometimes micro adjustments, according to what the defense, the fish, the river, the clarity, so forth, are giving me. I began doing that about 5 years ago, and I journal everything, Roger. I write everything down after every trip, and I started noticing that, you know, there was a pattern there, and I started basically demystifying what was going on. And I began to, you know, focus on the adjustments to match the conditions that I was given. And so those strengths I had, you know, as a guide and as a fly fisherman became, you know, really solid. And then I could start working on my weaknesses. So that's why I began that systematic approach.
And we've talked about where you guide a little bit, you know, in the Deckers area on the South Platte, which is considered a challenging stretch of river by most people's, you know, standards, I think. So this system that you've developed, is it improved? You know, I'm assuming it improved your fishing, but was it helpful to your clients as well? Is this something they could plug into easily?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, is it's real simple. You know, obviously, you've heard the old saying, keep it simple, stupid. Well, that's what this is all about. It's the simpler, the better. You begin with that, you know, that base knowledge, and you adjust from there. And, you know, with clients, some, you know, are not very experienced at all. You can get them on fish quickly. With the intermediate guys, you can clean up their drift and show them, you know, a few things here and there that are going to really improve, you know, their bag limit, you know, their bag. So, yeah, I've seen a marked improvement in not only my own fly fishing, but my clients as well.
Well, that's good for business, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Keeps people coming back. And so there's something that can learn by anybody, whether they're a beginner or even helpful to an expert as well, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Good, good. We've got a question from Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington. He says, are there times and conditions when you don't take a nymph-oriented approach? Can you help clarify and classify the different methods, Czech, European, etc.? How does your system work within these, or is it a combination of some of these things?
Well, as far as you know, the times and conditions where I don't take a nymph-oriented approach, those are few and far between. You know, I'm like any guy out there or any gal. You know, it's a lot of fun to catch fish on the surface, but my bread is buttered nymphing or, you know, a variation of nymphing. In other words, you know, I may be nymphing directly under an indicator or I may run a mini rig, which is basically a big, let's say, for example, a big stone fly up top, and I might drop 35, 40 inches to my dropper fly there below it and run a nymph below it and then maybe another point fly below that. So that's still kind of a nymph-oriented. It just happens to have, you know, a hook in the indicator. And, you know, so you're watching that big stone fly to see what it does. You know, if it stops, pauses, twitches, goes under, whatever. It acts as an indicator, but it also, you know, every now and then a fish will come up and eat it. So to answer that question, for the most part, I'm nymph-oriented. That's basically the way I fish. And, you know, most fish's diet, you know, 85-90% of it, you know, it's approximated is subsurface. As far as, you know, other methods, some of the Czech and European, I have Czech NIMPT. I enjoy it. I don't use it specifically, especially with clients, because I like the ability to use their sight at first using an indicator. To me, Czech NIMPTing is more about feel. But the same basic tenets are in place for all methods, and you're still looking at depth, speed, you know, of the drift, profile of the bug, and color of the bug. So, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on any of the Czech and European NIMPTing strategies.
Okay. Well, let's talk, because we did get a lot of questions in from our audience about equipment and rigging up. Of course, there's got to be, several dozen ways that you can rig up for NIMPTing. So let's kind of dig into some of these questions. We have Eric. He wants to know about rod. Eric's from Central Pennsylvania. He says, how important is the length of your rod when strictly NIMPTing? I hear about guys all the time taking 10-footers out on the streams in my area that are covered with brush and overhang. It seems like a hassle to be carrying a rod that long for such a small stream. So how can you help Eric out here?
Well, you know, I'll back up a little bit. My basic fly rod for NIMPTing is a 9-foot, 5-weight, mid-flex fly rod. And the reason I like that 9-foot 5 is because it gives me that extra length when I want to do some high sticking. It gives me that extra length when I need to do long line mending. I like the mid-flex because it's softer on the tippets, because, you know, you're setting quite a lot. Sometimes you'll set on every drift if you're ticking bottom. You know, it's pretty hard on tippets. You're going to be snapping off a lot of bugs if you use a pretty stiff action rod. I mean, I know guys that get away with it, but for me personally, a 9-foot 5 is what I like. That being said, I can remember as a kid in some of the smaller reservation creeks in Arizona fishing with a little 7.5-foot fly rod and nymphing with it. So you can get away with all types, but I think the longer the fly rod, the better. If you're fishing a narrow creek or a narrow stream with a lot of brush and overhang, I think, you know, what he's saying is what Eric said is right. You could still use a 10-foot fly rod in that case. It might be a little overkill, but if you're concentrating on upstream mending or upstream nymphing, it can be done as long as you're staying horizontal to the river, you know, or to the water flow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 9.5-footer, 5-weight. We had a question come in on the internet here. He's asking, Bart asks about rod length, line weight, and so we've pretty much covered that for Bart. So that's your standard rig. Talk about line. Primarily floating, I take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, again, I like a floating line because, you know, it's staying on top of the water. And then, you know, I go obviously to my leader, and I've got an indicator on there. Well, that whole line, you know, is laying on the water. That indicator serves as a hinge point for me. So everything's dropping below that indicator. So I have one hinge point, one basic contact point between me and the bugs. And all I have to do is dial in on that. But obviously, I tell people, you know, look at your indicator during the drift, but also keep, you know, everything in view within at least 5 feet of that indicator. You know, you're looking for flashes of fish and so forth to set on. But I like a good floating line for nymphing.
Okay. Mike Abramowitz asks about, says, could you please comment on leaders you use or tie yourself? I tie a heavy butt section starting with Mason Mono 20-pound. This tapers down with different sizes of maxima to the final tippet section. Do you include a different color of material to be your indicator?
No, as far as the indicator, no. And I no longer tie my own leaders. Well, I shouldn't say that. There are cases where I'll tie a leader or I'll tie my own hinged leader to do some nymphing. But for the most part, no, I'm throwing tapered leaders. I think they're absolutely wonderful. I remember as a kid tying all those blood knots and you know, you're sitting on the bank for 45 minutes and, you know, fishing for 45 before you have to retie. So I'm using, you know, and there's also a little bit of discussion, and it's worthy, but what I fish with, what I nymph with mostly is a 7.5-foot 5X. And people ask me all the time, is that long enough? And I always say, you know, if you think about it, you got 7.5 feet of leader, and you're putting another 18 inches of tippet on that, whether it's with a blood knot or a double surgeon. So right there, you've got 9 feet to your first fly. And then I'm going to drop off probably another 14 inches to a second fly from there. So we're covering a lot of water with that. And most of the rivers I fish, 7.5 feet is fine. Now, you get up into some of the bigger rivers in, you know, let's say Wyoming, and I will throw a 9-foot leader, but for the most part, I'm staying tapered leader 7.5, 5X.
Okay. And there's a question that come up here later. We might as well talk about that now, since you talked about the indicator. And he was asking, you know, some people use a colored section of, you know, leader
right.
to be their indicator. But you're using other forms of indicator. And John in Ithaca, New York, wants to know, you know, what kind of indicator do you use? Are some better than the others? What do you prefer?
I prefer the yarn indicator with the rubber band. I use a poly macrame yarn. You can pick it up at pretty much any craft store. You know, I'll cut that to length, and I put it on using the rubber band system. You brush it out real nice, and put some sort of floating on it, and it'll float all day for you. The beauty of that is, you know, I can trim it to size quickly, just with a pair of scissors, and it moves. I mean, all I have to do is grab the line, grab the indicator, and I can slide it any direction I want very, very quickly. And to me, not only when I'm fishing, but especially when I'm guiding, the ability to make those fast adjustments, you know, is key and critical. The only time I won't use that indicator is when it's super windy, because it does have a tendency to pick up, you know, to be a little glider across the water on you. And then at that point, I'll either use a little styrofoam or the thingamabobber or something along those lines.
Okay, okay. Now, any color that you feel works better, easier to see?
You know, in the mornings, if I know I'm going to go to a section where we're going to be fishing back into the sun and we have no other choice, I'll take a piece of, like, burgundy and a piece of the tan macrame, and I will mesh those together. You know, I'll do like a half and half. And basically what that does is that just gives me the ability and the client the ability to see it a little bit better. That's really the only time. You know, color to me, it's like fly line. You know, the color is for the fly fisherman, not the fish. You know, it's one of those things where if you're constantly bombing a run with fly line and an indicator and leader and bugs, it doesn't really matter, you know, what color it is you're going to put those fish down. So the color doesn't mean all that much to me. And I think what, was it Mike, I think? What he was talking about on the indicator portion, he's talking about the little section at the end of the fly line. There are a couple different versions out there. And I don't ascribe to those. I don't use those because we are using an indicator. If I was fishing just watching the butt of the leader to the fly line connection, like I used to nymph in the old days, then that color might come in handy. But no, I don't even focus on that now because we're using indicators.
Okay, okay. What about for both leader and tippet, mono or John in Pleasanton, California wants to know about mono versus fluorocarbon?
You know, I'm a monofilament guy. There are times, don't get me wrong, I use fluorocarbon and I see its value. But for the most part, I can get everything I want out of monofilament leaders. You know, they absorb the energy of the fly rod. They turn over nicely. They're pretty supple. The only time I'll go to a fluorocarbon leader or fluorocarbon tippets is, you know, when I'm fishing heavily pressured fish in gin clear water. Then I'll go with the fluoros. Also, if I'm fishing a river that, you know, has a lot of like jagged edge rocks, I have a tendency to run the fluoro as well because I think it's a little more abrasion resistant. Or like if I'm fishing a section that I know has a lot of shelves that drop into plunge pools quickly, you know, fluorocarbon is a lot more dense than monofilament, and so it sinks quicker. So, you know, I have uses for fluorocarbon, but where I guide predominantly, it's all monofilament.
Great, great. Dwayne, we've got to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dwayne more about his systematic approach to nymphing. Cortland Line Company recognizes the rapidly expanding market for the precise nymphing methods pioneered by European competitive angling community. Czech, French, Spanish nymphing styles increase productivity by keeping anglers in close contact with their flies. Extra long, light action rods and unique rigging are the rule with this type of fishing, but standard taper floating lines are often a hindrance. Cortland Line has been developing, testing, and perfecting the ultimate taper configuration to empower nymph fishermen using these new methods. And our new competition nymph line is finally ready for release. Look for the competition nymph line to be available this summer from Cortland. Your nymph rod has met its match. For more information on Cortland lines, visit www.cortlandline.com. That's www.cortlandline.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dwayne Redford about his systematic approach to nymphing. If you'd like to ask Dwayne a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But Dwayne, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests about what's going on in their fly fishing world, and why don't you tell us a bit about what you've been up to?
Well, I've been busy. When I'm not guiding, I've been out doing some book marketing, and I've got a son and a daughter here still at home, so I'm busy with the family. You know, guiding out of Flies and Lies has been a blessing because it's been keeping me very, very busy. There's a good group of people, clients that we have down there, and I just love that stretch of river. But other than that, it's, you know, you're getting into July, August, the dog days of guiding, and so we're just keeping my head down and keep going.
Well, now, where can people get your book?
Thanks for asking, Roger. You can go to www.flyfishersplaybook.com.
Okay, www.flyfishersplaybook.com.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can order it right online there.
Okay. And do you want to share the shop's website that you're guiding out of there, too, in case people want to look you up down there?
You bet. Thank you very much. You can go to southplatteoutfitters.com.
Southplatteoutfitters.com. Right?
Okay. Yeah. And the name of the shop is Flies and Lies. So.
Okay, Flies and Lies.
Mostly lies there, Roger.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that. And, folks, if you want to get Dwayne's book, you know where to get it now, and check it out. Excellent book with nice illustrations. We're going to talk more about that right now. So one of the questions, too, that John in Pleasanton asks, and this can kind of get into our rigging here, he asks about, you talk about split shot placement above or below the flies. And I know you kind of, from your book, you rig up differently depending on situations, right?
Yeah, there will be different rigs for different situations, and it all comes down to where the fish are feeding in the column. So that's part of reading that defense. You know, which column, which, you know, vertical column in the water are they feeding? So, if you know, they might be feeding, basically I break it up into lower column, middle column, and upper column, and they're basically, you know, one-third each. If I have fish that are down, you know, in the lower column, feeding, you know, I can see them feeding side to side, swaying back and forth. I'm pretty confident that they're eating the nymph of whatever bug they're eating. At that point, I'm going to run my 7.5 liter, and I'm going to tie 18 inches of tippet on there. At that junction where that knot is, I'm going to put my weight above it. Then I'll put my first fly, my dropper, you know, at that 18-inch mark, and then I'll come down another 12 to 14 inches for my point fly. What a lot of people don't realize is what you want is you want that weight ticking on the bottom. You don't necessarily want your flies ticking on the bottom. Now, sometimes, you know, you have to just with hydraulics and the weight of the, you know, the dropper bug. But for the most part, I want, you know, that first bug, that dropper, about, you know, anywhere between 2 and 6 inches off of the bottom. So, you know, because the fish is not going to be sitting directly on the bottom. They're just not going to have their belly down on that sand. My second fly is going to be, because it's further from that weight, is actually going to be higher in the column. So let's say I have a fish that's feeding, you know, 12 inches off the bottom. Well, I'm going to have a chance to hook that fish with either that first or second fly because, I'm trying to explain this here, you know, the weight's on the bottom. If you could imagine looking at, you know, looking at a cross section, you've got your weight on the bottom, your first fly is 18 inches from that weight and it's off the bottom, and your second fly is 12 to 14 inches from that and it's even further off the bottom. The further from the weight, the higher the fly. So if I'm fishing that lower column, that's how I'm going to rig. Now sometimes in super deep sections, we're not going to be able to really get those bugs all the way down to the bottom. So let's say we have you know, a fish in the middle column. And obviously, fishing it, ticking that weight off the bottom, we're not going to be able to get those bugs onto that fish. So I want to go with the depth of the flies from the top down to where that fish is feeding. That really doesn't change where my weight is. It just changes, you know, how I fish it. It changes the depth of the flies below the indicator. The weight is not for depth as much as it is for speed. And a lot of people get confused about that. That weight is put on there to cause drag to slow those bugs down, or you pinch them off to quicken them up. You know, you get your depth from the distance from the indicator. When I'm throwing, I talked earlier about throwing a mini rig where you have, you know, like a big stonefly up top and two bugs below it. In that case, I'm going to put my weight between the last two bugs. So let's go over that again. You've got your, you know, your stonefly up top on the surface. Let's say it's a big Amy's ant. I'm dropping 40 inches down to my dropper fly, and then another, let's say, 10 inches down to the point fly. My weight is going to go right on that tippet between those last two flies. I use that more for a hinge point. You know, that fly line kind of breaks in the middle there between those two flies, and it, you know, helps get through that surface film, and it actually pulls those flies down for you.
Okay, let's say we were fishing, like your first example, and we're fishing down on the bottom, and I'm not quite sure what they're feeding on, so maybe I want to fish a stonefly and a, you know, another, you know, maybe a mayfly nymph or something like a pheasant tail. Where would you put each of those, and how would you fish it?
I'd fish the stonefly first, and that would go 18 inches from my weight, and then I would fish my pheasant tail as my point fly, you know, 12 to 14 inches from that stonefly. That's how I would rig that. And that's a pretty good rig, pretty good standard rig, you know, for searching for fish.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly how I do that, and I would just micromanage my weight as far as, you know, slowing those bugs down and getting them exactly in the column where I want them. And that's all part of that systematic process.
How do we find, if let's say I'm not seeing any fish, how do I find that column point? I mean, how do you determine that?
That is a great question. Well, you know, I refer to that as blind nymphing. You know, I'm pretty sure there's fish in this run, but I can't see them. So when I blind nymph, I fish from the bottom up. In other words, I'm going to start on the bottom with my weight ticking on the bottom, and I'm going to work, you know, the seam I'm working in, I'm going to work it from the bottom. If I'm fishing, if I can see fish, maybe let's say they're in the, you know, the middle column, then I'll fish those fish top down. You know, I've never seen a fish, and there might be people out there, but I've never seen a fish move down in the column to eat. You know, they're just not built that way. It's like us. You know, you put your hand under your chin and you really can't see it. They're basically the same way. They can't see underneath their mouth. So, it makes me think that they're not going to move down to eat something as opposed to moving up. So if I can see that fish in the middle column, that fish is probably going to eat at level or above. So I will tack that fish from the top down. You know?
So we've talked about two rigs here. We've talked about the deep rig for the lower column, which is going to be weight ticking off the bottom, and then, would you say, 12 to 18 inches for the first fly, another 12, 15 inches to the second fly, something like that. And so you should actually be feeling that weight ticking on the bottom to know that you're on the bottom?
Well, actually, you know, with using the floating line and the indicator, again, it's by sight. I tell my clients all the time, it's like playing, you know, a video game. It's how quickly you can move when you see something happen. And that indicator is telling you what's going on subsurface. So you're not going to feel anything until you actually, you know, prick that fish. That's when you're going to feel it.
I guess what I was trying to get at is, how do you know you're deep enough?
Oh, good. Okay, I see what you said. Well, first of all, you probably, that ticking will be relayed up through your indicator. You might see it actually, you know, bouncing a little bit. But, you know, probably the more common way is you'll be hooking up on bottom every now and again, and so then you know how to make that adjustment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, I'm too deep in here, maybe I can pinch off a little weight and get that moving a little faster. You know, and that's another skill that I try to work with my clients on is it's a lot different to fish a section of water. So we'll go in and fish a section of water, and then I'll ask them, how deep do you think that is? And, you know, for the most part, they give me, you know, an answer, and then we'll go step into it. And it's amazing how different that depth is. And so through practice like that, after you fish a run sometime, just go step into it. Say, oh, man, so I was way off.
Mm.
Or, you know, if you fish in real clear water, you can put on a brightly colored bug, you know, like say maybe a big pink San Juan, and watch it. Just observe it.
Mm-hmm.
And see where it is.
One question that kind of fits in here that Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington had is, he says, what's the best way to gain strike recognition? And I think what he's asking is, like what we're talking about now, we've got this ticking, you know, and you got your indicator ticking from contact with the bottom, the weight, and so forth. How do you know what's a strike and what isn't when you set, you know, how do you read that indicator properly?
That's a great question. And I'll start off by saying, if you watch your real accomplished nymph fly fishers, they're going to be setting pretty much on every drift. They'll set on something. Basically, what I'm looking for, along with, you know, if I can see anywhere around that indicator, and this just comes from, you know, habit and practice, but if once you learn, you know, to notice a fish flash, and you saw what the indicator did, sometimes it does nothing, but and you notice what the indicator did at that point, you start to recognize when to set and when not to set. Basically, I tell my clients, set on everything. They're free. Use them up. You know, just go ahead and set everything. What a lot of intermediate guys do is I'll notice that they will throw a mend in when they see their indicator, you know, stop or twitch or pause. They'll throw a mend to it as opposed to setting it. And the amount of fish you'll start catching is pretty amazing when you start setting on everything. People just don't realize how many fish are eating down there, you know, that you don't even see and you don't recognize. So every little twitch, every little pause, obviously if it dunks under, that's a nice take. Go ahead and enjoy that. But for the most part, it is super subtle. You know, fish, they eat and spit faster than a baby, so, you know, you got to be right on top of it.
Right, right. Now, and just to clarify, too, going back to the, you know, the hopper-dropper kind of setup there, you said the bottom two fly, you go down about 40 inches from maybe your floating fly, and then you have your first fly and then your second fly down below that. You said you're going to put the weight down there. Where exactly are you putting it, between the two flies, just on the line?
Yep, it's on the tippet, okay. Right between the two flies. And, you know, let me clarify. Sometimes, Roger, that distance below that dropper fly is 18, or that floating fly is 18 inches. I mean, it just depends on what column you're trying to get into. But, yeah, if you're going to weight it, and if you have two bugs, put the weight between the bottom two.
Okay. And there's another question here. Otis in Reno asked, do you ever end your rig with a lighter weight 6-inch tippet with split shot, the idea being that this gets lost in a snag and preserves the remaining tippet, also keeps multiple flies at different levels?
No, I don't do it for that reason. You know, if I'm going to go, sometimes I will go with a lighter tippet between my last couple of flies. When fish get a little stingy and they get pretty selective, I may go with a lighter tippet down there, or, you know, even put fluoro in between the two. But that's not the reason I do it. You know, I realize when you're nymphing, you're going to lose bugs. It's just that simple.
Well, he's also talking about putting the weight on the end of the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Line.
Yeah,
doesn't that change the kind of floating pattern or configuration?
Right. And I have done that in the past, and I've gotten away from it because, you know, I want those bugs, like I described earlier, I want the weight on the bottom and those bugs off the bottom. Unless I'm going from top down, like we talked about, my weight is always above my flies.
I would think if it was at the end, you'd get less of a floating action with the flies. It would seem like they would.
Mm-hmm. And I think that also those fish, you know, would probably feel a little more tension a lot quicker right off the take.
Right.
You know, I think they'd eat and spit a little bit faster.
Well, now, what about tying these flies on? I think you have specific methods and reasons for whether you're tying a tag or directly to the eye or to the bend. And you want to kind of go through that for folks?
Sure. And in the past, I have used tags, but I don't run them anymore. I like my system better. What I do is, if I'm fishing a nymph that can't swim well, let's say I'm fishing a big old stonefly nymph, I'm going to tie that fly from the eye of the hook to the bend. And that causes that fly to tumble in the water. you know, for example. If I'm going to fish, let's say I'm fishing a blueing emerger, say like today I was throwing some pheasant tail soft tackles, and I tie that fly in my rig eye to eye. So let's say it's the first dropper in my rig, I'm tying it eye down to eye. Now that forces that bug to sit straight out in the water, you know, straight out, gives it a different profile in the water. So that's my, you know, my method. You know, that's basically, and plus, you know, with that fly that way, it makes it a lot more sticky, for lack of a better term. You know, you try to run your hand up and down that fly line, you know, to move things around, and that fly's sticking out there. It's out there for a reason. You know, that hook is right there.
Okay, so in our first example, or the example I gave you, I've got a stone fly and a mayfly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pheasant tail hanging off. So I'm going to tie my tippet to the eye of the stone fly, and I'm going to go from the bend of the stone fly to the eye of the pheasant tail, and that's where I'm at, right, on that situation.
Right.
So I was doing a three-fly rig, and I had a third fly on the end, and it was a swimmer, then mayfly in the middle would be tied eye from the stone fly to the eye of the mayfly, and then from the eye of the mayfly to the next fly, whatever that was.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Just want to make sure I got that all straight. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, you mentioned stone flies aren't good swimmers. They just kind of tumble around. Are there any other particular insect, any nymphs that you would consider bad swimmers?
Yeah, like a crane fly larva.
Crane
would be another, another lousy swimmer.
I mean,
they're just not built for it. You know, you've got your worms, you've got your annelids, you know, those to me, I'm on putting those to try to match that tumbling profile that the fish is going to see.
But like your mayflies and your caddis that are swimming to the surface, that's where you consider your good swimmers, right?
Yep, that's my eye to eye. Even my, you know, like my midge pupa, as they're coming up, you know, I'm going to try to get that profile flat in the water, so that's an eye to eye bug for me.
Okay, good. Keeps it simple, too.
Mm-hmm.
Without having the tags on there and so forth. And I know we were asked about knots. When you're tying the flies on, what kind of knots are you using there?
Just the regular clinch knot. That's what I've been tying. And, you know, I don't even throw the improved part in there. I've found over the years that, you know, if I really lube it up and pull everything nice and tight, then that knot is going to hold. One thing on knots is whenever I hear one squeak when I'm tightening it, I'll snip it and start over because it's, you know, that little squeak in there, to me,
means
friction. Yeah, and that's friction.
So
I'll just retie it.
Yeah, good.
But they're all clinch knots.
Okay. Time to take another quick break here, and we'll be right back with Dwayne and his systematic approach to nymphing. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dwayne Redford about a systematic approach to nymphing. If you'd like to ask Dwayne a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Oh, here's a question. Leo in Pennsylvania says, do you tie the droppers at the hook eye of the upper fly? I'm thinking he's talking about the floating fly. We just discussed the other connections.
Oh, that's a great question. No, yeah. I come off the bend on that. Because that'll, you know, if you go off the eye on that, it'll have a tendency to make that fly tilt.
Okay.
You know, it'll be nose down.
Got another question off the internet. Jim asks, and Westcliff asks, what do you prefer, weighted or unweighted nymphs?
In high flows, I want as much help as I can get. So, like, today my top fly was a tongue stone, or it was a Pat's rubber leg, you know, where it's 630, 640 CFS. That's pretty high flows for the South Platte down there. So I am weighting those flies. For the most part, however, in more seasonal conditions, it really doesn't matter to me. It's more about the profile of the bug. You know, I like to manage everything off of that split shot. That's my connection to the world right there, is that split shot. So it's conditional.
Okay. We had Neil. This is what you're just talking about, basically. Neil in Fayetteville, Arkansas says, I'm curious as a general theory on leader length and the use of split shot. Is it better to go with a heavier nymph or to add weight as dictated by conditions? So I guess that's what you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And because I know it's hard to always, you know, keep weighted, unweighted, which ones are weighted, which ones aren't, you know.
Oh, I know, I know.
It's confusing. I know, you know, fishing salt, you're doing that with crabs, you know, weighting different
mm-hmm.
crabs so they float quicker, faster to the bottom. And it does get quite confusing. But is there, this is Josh Wainwright in Maryland. He asks, is there a formula for sizes of nymphs? Should they start with a large one and descend to smaller or vice versa?
Typically, my first bug, my first dropper, is going to be my bigger and probably flashier fly. I'm using that as much as an attractor as anything. For the most part, they kind of descend in order as far as size. That's my method. So I might throw a big stone fly up top, and then let's say a soft tackle pheasant tail in there at about a size 18, and I might drop a size 22 midge larva off the bottom of that. So for the most, because, again, the further you get away from that weight, the higher those bugs get in the column.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to use that descending order and those sizes to help me manage that drift.
Mm-hmm. And then the weight kind of works with you, too, of the flies, right?
Exactly.
The lighter
exactly.
ones float higher, and then everyone stayed out below, okay?
Exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the flies that you prefer for nymphing, and I know we can't get real specific because we got people all over the world actually listening to the show. So, but Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee, he wants to know, when you are in new water, do you have a go-to nymph that you use, and what are your top five nymphs? It's always a tough question, but
mm-hmm.
I guess he's, you know, looking for that searching patterns, and where do
sure.
you start?
Well, you know, and I've mentioned this in my book, but when I go to new water that I've never fished before, I'm definitely going to stop into the local fly shop. That's the first thing I'm going to do, and talk to those guys in there. Let's say, for example, there isn't a fly shop near that water. Then I'm probably going to run a stone fly pattern with probably a pheasant tail below it. Now, that being said, the minute you get in that water, you know, you're rigged up a certain way. You got your base rigged, but let's say all of a sudden I see some blue wings coming off. And, you know, I notice fish that are feeding in the middle column. Well, then, obviously, I'm going to go to my blue wing emerger patterns. Then there's dozens out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd probably start off with my two base bugs would be a stonefly and a pheasant tail, and then from there I would, unless it's seasonal, let's say I'm there in the spring and the rainbows are spawning, then I might run an egg fly. Or if I'm there in the fall and the browns are spawning, I might run an egg fly.
Yeah.
If it just had a heavy downpour, I might run tan sand one worm. So it just, yeah, that is completely conditional, but I always have stoneflies, blue wings, pheasant tails, copper johns, and I love a little bug called a periwinkle.
Hmm.
And it's a combination. You can fish it as a midge larva, or you can fish it as a blue wing nymph. And it's a great bug. So if I had to carry just five flies to new water, which would just about kill me, Roger, those would be the five I'd carry, probably.
It's kind of like that. You feel like you're standing naked in the stream, you know, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, with only five flies, yeah.
You know, and you ask me this question tomorrow, and I'd probably give you five different ones.
Yeah.
No, it's just, you know, that's why that base nymph rig that we talked about is so important, because it gives you the ability to switch quickly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we always get those questions like that coming in, and, you know, a lot of times the copper john, the pheasant tail, the stone fly, hare's ear is always one that seems to come up,
mm-hmm.
you know. They're just buggy, right? I mean,
Yeah.
buggy looking. And I know, you know, every time, like you just gave me a whole list of flies the other day for the, you know, South Platte when I went down there, going, well, I haven't used some of these. But, you know, we have our favorites, and they may simulate the same bug. And you may do just as well with your set, you know, as the local guide. But it really comes down to knowing what's happening under there more than,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, you can search, but there's only so much searching you can do, and then you really have to know what's going on if you want to be
Well, exactly. you know, you read the water, you read the fish, and you read the entomology, and I always call it reverse engineering on the entomology. You know, I'm seeing what's coming off, and then, you know, the ability to quickly discern what that fly is and the size it is, and making that switch is key and critical.
Yep.
So you're exactly right. There's a lot of buggy bugs out there, but, you know, if I'm not matching that bug and if I'm not getting the drift correct, then you're in for a long day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'll throw this one out here. Suresh in Texas asks, is there any particular favorite color nymph you go to when fishing is tough? That makes much of a difference?
Well, I will say this. In off-color water, I'm going big, colorful, and nasty. You know, I'll run, you know, a big stonefly pattern and probably a big pink worm and a big cranefly larva. So basically, depending on the water clarity, you know, I'm going to run different colored bugs. The nastier the water, in my opinion, the brighter the bug, the bigger the bug. But
I guess we can kind of look at that from the standpoint of, like, the fish are looking through fogged-up glasses, and
you've got
to make something stand out, right? I mean, a little teeny midge is not even going to be seen.
Yeah, exactly. And typically, that's a great point. Typically, in high, fast water, you know, it's just going to be murky. And so those fish are not going to be willing to move. I mean, they're working hard enough staying right where they are in their slot. So they're not going to move. Even if they do see a midge probably 4 inches away, they may not move for it. Whereas if they see a big old stonefly coming down, you know, it's like, oh, there's protein. I need that to stay where I am. So, you know, that's kind of the way, you know, I think. I may be way off. Fish may think differently than I do. But.
Another question from John Ward in Ithaca. He asks, use wide gap or standard style hooks and why? And is there a particular brand you use or model numbers that you use most?
I use them both. I know from my emerging nymphs and my, like my midge pupa and so forth, I like the 2487 series of Temcos, anywhere from a size 16 to 26. That's my, just for me personally, when I'm tying up my emergers, that's the kind of, I like the way, you know, it's got a little bit of bend in that hook. I can tie it a little bit further down onto the bend, get a good profile, because to me it's all about the profile of the bug. Get a good profile. And plus, you know, the hook set ratio I think is a little bit better on those smaller bugs. You know, wintertime we're throwing 24, 26. I like a little bit wider hook.
Yeah, not much gap in those 26s, is there?
No. But it's amazing. It never ceases to amaze me the amount of big fish that are caught on those little, you know, flies. And it's just, I'm still amazed by that after all these years. You know, little size 26, you know, little midge pupa, and you can catch big fish on that.
Well, I tell you what amazes me is how it doesn't matter what size hook I'm using, I have no trouble getting it hooked into my skin or my clothes. And I just can't figure out why the fish aren't having the same problem, you know?
Like,
how did he miss that? I mean, it would have stuck in my hand if I was, you know, trying to grab it, so I just don't get that. Never will, I guess, but anyway, I know we all have that problem. But
yep.
That's why I clamp down those barbs, right?
That's right, yeah. Exactly.
John in Redwood City, California wants to know about beads. He says, can they be counterproductive, causing a fish to spurn a nymph versus the benefit of the added weight or attracting a fish's attention?
I think in some instances beads can be counterproductive, but I think it's about 50-50. You know, I like the whole Mercury series of flies because it's a clear bead, and, you know, I like to emulate that air bubble. So I like a clear bead on my flies. You know, that's a tough question. That's 50-50. One thing I will say is when I get a high sky during the day and the river's pretty clear, I'm going to fish flies that don't have beads. I mean, that's just the way I am. I snip everything off and go with a slim profile. Same pattern, but a slimmer profile, no bead. So,
okay.
You know, and again, the depth is dictated. You can dictate it with, you know, the basic nymph rig as far as where you put that weight.
Right.
How much
weight
you put on. So,
we had a question come in on the internet. Brian in Dayton, Ohio asks, he says, if you're not getting any takes for an extended period of time, how many different sizes of a pattern will you generally try before switching to a different color or pattern? So,
that's,
you know, sticking with the same fly, you're pretty sure that it's a mayfly nymph that they're feeding on, but you're not quite sure of the size, so you're going up and down and before, you know, How much playing around do you do with that before you go to something totally different?
That's a good question. You know what? I'm going to change my depth and my speed a dozen times before I even think about changing that fly out.
Mm.
You know, if my depth and speed are incorrect, then, you know, it doesn't matter really. I mean, I might still hook up every now and then, but if my depth and speed aren't right, then that fly size is not going to make a whole lot of difference in my mind. When I do change, if I know it's a mayfly, you know, that they're eating, when I do change, I typically go one size smaller. That's usually my move. Now, if I'm not picking that, let's say I'm sight fishing a fish, if I'm not picking that fish up, you know, I may give that fish a good workout, but I'm not going to stay there forever. You know, I'm going to keep moving upstream. That being said, I was guiding last week with a good friend of mine, and he was trying to catch just a beautiful rainbow. He put his client on a beautiful rainbow between two rocks, and they threw every variation of a bug that they could at this fish, and he knew that his depth and speed was right. He stuck with it, finally said, okay, we're going to give it one more try. So he snipped off all the bugs and put a squirrel tail leech on there. First drift, bang. Hmm. So, you know, go figure. That doesn't happen very often, but like my 3-year-old granddaughter says, you know, when I ask her what fish she eats, she says mashed potatoes. So, you know, that's this. It is, they're going to eat selectively or opportunistically whatever mood they're in. You know, that particular fish might have been looking for one stage of one bug. It might have been looking for the emerger stage of a blue wing or the emerger stage of a PMD. And in that case, basically, I don't waste my time with those fish. I keep moving on.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe fish have kind of the same attraction that we have as humans to, you know, we're always attracted to the next shiny object, right? You know?
Yeah.
Kind of like, well, I've got a nice car, but boy, that was a really nice car that just drove by, you know? And maybe they kind of are influenced by, you know, the shiny object effect as well, and literally at times, but yeah. Well, we need to take another quick break here, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about reading the water and some presentation techniques, and I know you have a lot to say about that, so hang with me, and we'll be right back. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dwayne Redford about a systematic approach to nymphing. If you'd like to ask Dwayne a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's talk about reading the water. How important, I mean, you've mentioned water clarity here a little bit, but there's a few other factors, water clarity, water temperatures, water flows, weather. How do all these play a role when you're out there on the water and what do you do about them? How do you address them?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's all part of the trout defense. That's the way I look at it. And so I need to break it down. We've already talked about clarity and what you do, you know, in big, nasty water. You know, how you rig appropriately in gin clear water. We've kind of touched on both of those. What I'm doing, first and foremost, is I'm looking for your typical runs. Now, a lot of people call, you know, the run the glide section in an area. In a section of the river, I break it down even farther. So when I'm looking at the river, I'm breaking it up into river left, river center, river right. And then each one of those sections, you could find a typical run in each one of those. And a typical run in my mind is a riffle to a shelf to a pool to kind of mid-pool to a tail out to another riffle. And so that's what I'm looking for. And then I'm also looking for adjoining seams, because the seams are super highways, you know, for food. And so that's what I'm looking for, adjoining seams. Now, when I fish, you know, I have found that the upper, half to a quarter is probably your most productive section of a typical run. In other words, that shelf area and the riffle above it. But, you can catch fish anywhere in there. What you're looking for is, what the fish need. They need food, they need oxygen, and they need shelter. And so if you follow that accordingly, how do you find oxygen in a river? Well, it's usually in a riffle section because that water's being churned and it's being mixed. And so I know that the fish are probably going to be holding somewhere near a riffle section or a foam line because that represents air. So I know that that's a good spot for fish to hold. Yeah, I'm looking for shelter. Are there obstructions nearby? Are there undercuts in banks and so forth? And then obviously the food will take care of itself, but a lot of your food is coming right off that riffle section. That's being churned up constantly. And so that's how I approach a run. And when I fish that run, I'm looking for the lies. You've got your prime lies where your big dominant fish are going to hold. There's only so many of those in a typical run. So I'm going to look for those, but I'm also looking for those subordinate, the secondary lies or subordinate lies where your subordinate fish hold. And I would be willing to say that we probably catch the majority of our fish in those subordinate holds.
Where is the primary lies?
The prime lies are going to be, let's say there's a boulder and there's a nice seam coming up and around it. That prime lie may be tucked right up against that boulder right in there, where that fish only has to move a few inches to eat out of that seam, but safety is only just a fin flip away. He's got plenty of oxygen right there. That, to me, is a prime lie.
Okay, when you say up against the boulder, let's say I'm looking straight down on that boulder. So I got a boulder and I got, seams coming off both sides of that. You saying he's back downriver from that boulder in the seam?
Depending on the characteristics of it, that's a good bet, Roger. He's down. He's still tucked close to that boulder, but he's just downstream and a little bit behind it.
Okay.
There may also be a prime lie directly in front of that boulder. We don't know what else is there, but that's a good prime lie as well.
Yeah, right, I've seen fish. Surprised me at times to see a fish right out in front of that thing. So, yeah.
And when you're looking at, say, a bend, your prime lies are more likely going to be on that far side of that bend where there might be overhanging brush or limbs. There might be a beaver dam back there. There might be an undercut in the bank. That's a good spot. Right up next to the bank, they've got all the shelter they need. They've got a food superhighway. So then there's plenty of oxygen. So prime-wise, those are the things that you just have to get used to finding them. Once you start identifying different types of lies, you'll start actually knowing where your dominant fish are going to hold.
So. Now, when you talk about, a bend in the river, that could be configured a number of different ways. In other words, we could have a bend with a run down the middle and a seam on both sides of the run, right? With
exactly.
Slack water on both sides.
Yep.
Do you find it better to fish a bend like that from one side or the other if you have a choice? In other words, do you want to be on the interior side fishing the interior seam and trying to fish the exterior seam or vice versa?
I like to work bends. My favorite way to work a bend, if it's possible, is start on the inside of the bend and start in the lower, kind of the mid-pool section of that bend. And you'll be able to locate it because a lot of times in a bend you'll have a little riffle section leading into the bend, then you have the bend itself and then tail out. So I like to start kind of in the lower section of that and fish my way up and in. I always tell my clients fish inside out. What I'm looking to do is completely and totally pick that bend apart to the point where I'm getting finally all the way over to the other side. And, I typically teach to keep a nice short line, 15 feet of fly line out and high stick through there as much as you possibly can. I like to manage, just a couple feet of monofilament line on the water at any time. If we can possibly use a nice, flat, high fly rod to get through there, we'll do it. If we have to start throwing mends to it, and do some long line stuff, it gets a little trickier. Obviously, it can be done, but it takes a little bit more practice. But I'm going to fish it inside out, bottom to top.
I'm looking at, and when you say inside out, bottom to top, I know you're thorough. I'm looking at
page 76 in your book, because you've got many illustrations in here of your, you know, a grid system that you kind of use to break down the river. But I'm looking at this one section of river, and I'm guessing it's maybe 50 feet wide in that picture. Kind of hard to tell because I don't have anything to judge size. But
I know which picture you're talking about. That was about, yeah, it's about a 50-foot section. It's pretty close.
So you've got where you've moved into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 positions, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, at least 20 different casts to cover that water. That's being thorough. I mean, I can see where many times I look at that and I might cover that with half the cast, if that many even, and then move on. So that must mean that there's something to that. Do you want to go into that, why you do that and the importance
of
that?
Sure, sure. When I walk away from a run, if we haven't moved a fish in there, I want to at least know that I fished it right, that we gave it everything we had. So the way I look at it, I overlay that grid on there in my mind, and I want to pick it apart piece by piece by piece. And, you know, each one of those casts, that might represent two casts in each spot. It might represent one, whatever. But it also gives the client the impression, because you are, you're moving. You know, you're actually changing as you go, bing, 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 bing. I want to go in the faster water. I want my grid to be closer together. In the slower the water, I want my grid to be farther apart. So in the faster water, I'm going to try to hit. And I know it's tough to hit with, you know, big indicator on there and, you know, three flies and a weight. I know it's tough to hit pinpoint, but I want to try to keep those casts as close together on that fast water. And you'll notice in the diagram, you know, I'll stand in one spot and I'll hit it, you know, cast one, cast two, cast three while I'm moving out through that grid. But then I don't just go straight upstream. I back out, and then I go in at an angle to the next area where I can effectively hit that next section and cover it. So, you know, to me, the grid is key and critical because I can walk away from that knowing that I fished it well, and you'd be amazed at how many fish you'll pick up on the inside edges. You know, a lot of guys just step in and go blown right over to the outside edge, and they're standing where they should be fishing. And, you know, if we work from the inside out, you know, you're going to pick up those subordinate secondary live fish as you work your way in.
Yeah, I notice, you know, sometimes when I'm fishing a stream like that and I'm in a position, I'm trying to get a different drift from where I'm standing than I've had the past five casts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while it dawns on me, you know, I'm not going to get a different drift from where I'm standing. It's just the way the water is going to take it, you know, no matter, you know, there's not a whole lot I can do. But then if I move 2 feet up or 2 feet back or 2 feet to the left, you know, then I get a different drift, you know, and I'm covering different water. It seems pretty simple and logical, but sometimes I think we get stuck in the mud, so to speak, and keep thinking we're covering more water when we really aren't. You know, that fly's going down the same channel every time, down the same spot, and, hey, if there's no fish there, you know, you need to move over a little bit, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, from your book, I mean, just by looking at those pictures, I look at that and I go, I got to work the water much more thoroughly than, you know, I've done in the past to be more successful, that's for sure. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And you know, I don't want people to think that for a minute you're going to be bored nymphing that way, because you are constantly picking your next target. You know, you're fishing it well, you're dialed in, you're leaning out, you know, you've got a good bend in your body. You're leaning out front. You've got that rod tip right over that indicator or right at that indicator. You're fishing that entire drift, the initial, the middle, the final stage. You're putting a little position set at the end. Take your next target, step, bang. And, you know, I don't want people to think that it's boring, because it's actually, it's a lot of fun. You just keep right on moving.
Now, we did get a question on the Internet from Mike in Pennsylvania. He says, I want to know if Dwayne changes his techniques when targeting fish he can see as opposed to casting the likely spots where he assumes there might be a fish. And the grid system we were just talking about is pretty much blind casting,
right,
trying to find fish.
Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of address Mike's question about sight fishing?
You bet. That's great. Sight fishing to me, sight nymphing in particular, I think is the epitome of nymphing. Once you get to the point where not only are you good enough to put your flies where you want them, and dial in that depth and speed, but also to see the fish is fantastic. I'll give you an example today. I had a client, we were fishing a deep little plunge pool. We stepped up, we were working our way upstream, nice and slow, left, you know, one step at a time. We see a really nice rainbow sitting right there on top of the shelf in the riffle in about a foot of water. And so what I did is I shortened up my depth on my indicator. We were probably at about 4.5, 5 feet. I shortened it up to about, you know, solid 4 feet. I don't want to go too close because I don't want that fish to see that indicator, you know, when the bugs hit. I pinched off the weight, put a little bit of micro putty on there, you know, tungsten putty to get the right depth, and I, you know, we laid the line out downstream, the correct amount with my client. I said, lay it out downstream, so you let that line just trail down below you, get his feet set. I said, pick a spot about 4 feet above that fish and just let it see bugs only. And he laid that right in there, and on the first cast, that fish ate. I'd like to say we landed that fish, but we didn't. It was just a beautiful fish. So sight nymphing, yes, it's different, but again, it's all about depth, speed, profile, and color. But you want to put those bugs 4 feet, 3 feet, depending on the speed of the water. You have to be able to gauge how far above that fish you have to throw those flies to get it right down on that fish's nose. And obviously the grid goes out the window because we're putting bugs on that fish's face.
Right.
So your sight nymphing is, like I said, the epitome to me.
Yeah, and that's where you really need to know what's your weight, your flies, your line, the current, you know, the speed of the water.
Exactly.
Yep. I'll read this one because this is kind of he kind of brings it all together. Larry Hull in Indian River asks, he says, every once in a while I'll try nymphing but get bored or frustrated or both. There are so many different variables to consider. Nymph selection, depth of your presentation, where to place the weight on your terminal rig, the mood of the fish, etc. When you're not getting action, how do you know when to give up on a run and move on or make some other sort of adjustment, keep casting? But the first part of, we've kind of addressed the other things that he's asking, but just
right.
His identifying all the factors there. And
right. Yeah.
For you to be the expert fly fisher, is you have to really understand all those, don't you?
You do. And it you know, that's why I wrote the playbook, because, you know, it was as much for me when I started it as it was for my clients. But that's what's marked my success and successes of my clients, is the simple fact that we know that stuff. And I put that into play. And the clients, they pick it up real fast. They get it. It's like, okay, I see. I need to fish my way inside out. I need to have a good drift. You know, I need to have all the tenets in place. And, you know, within, even, you know, beginners will pick that all up real fast. In a half-day guide trip, you know, when they come back to see me the next time, they pretty much have it dialed in. It's not as tough as you may think it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just thorough.
It's just thorough.
And I just hate to hear, you know, folks getting bored nymphing, because to me, it is about as exciting as it can get, especially when you get into the sight nymphing. It is just a blast.
Actually, I think, you know, when you think about it, I think nymphing is more of a challenge than dry fly fishing, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's much easier to lay a dry fly out there and just, you know, let it sit, you know, get a nice drift. But you're not worried about what water column they're in, you know, where they're holding, that kind of thing. It's like, to me, a lot easier. It's exciting, too. But nymphing requires a lot more of your skill, I think, in many respects. James in Wales, the UK, asks, he says, can you tell me which is the most productive method for nymphing for trout? Is it direct up in front, or is it upstream at a 45 angle and watch the end of your line for anything unusual? So I use two nymphs, one on a dropper and one on a point nymph. Seem to be struggling at the moment as nymphing is new to me and I usually fish using dry flies. So I think you kind of talked about this before, but is your approach more upriver more times than not?
Yeah, my approach is more times than not upriver, and it's usually roughly at a 45 up. The key is, you know, given that good 45 up, getting that fly line off the water, getting that drift, you know, by the time you get those flies directly out in front of you, your fly should have been down to the right depth, you know, for the last 5 feet. You want to get them down there that quickly. And most people, they miss the best part of that drift, which is the swing. As those flies start coming up in the column below you, you know, the greed reflex takes over and those fish will start eating, you know, they'll eat because they either think it's going to get away or it's emerging. And so you just put a little position set down there. It's a lot like
skipping a rock off the water, only backwards, in little position set, pick the fly rod up, let the water load the fly rod, and then recast. There are times when we will do direct upstream work, and that takes a little practice as far as how you mend that. You know, you still have to mend to that, but you mend off the bottom of your fly rod tip. And there's all diagrams in the book, and I hopefully explained it really well in the book. But both ways are effective, but sometimes you have to do one way, sometimes the other.
Well, let's, you know, just to kind of end things here because we're running out of time. The example you gave of a boulder, and we've got the water moving around it, and that prime lie right next to or just behind the boulder. You see that out there. You figure there's a good fish in that, or there should be. What would your approach be to that specific situation as far as coming up to that and casting to that position?
Even if, you know, I'm going to assume that there's a fish holding in there. Mm-hmm. So let's say I don't even see one, but I assume. I'm going to come in from a downstream angle to that boulder, probably at about a 45-degree angle. From downstream, moving up, I'm going to have the line trailing out below me already, so I don't have a lot of fly rod flash going over that. You know, I don't want that fish to see that fly rod flash. I'm going to pick up, I'm going to start, you know, I'm not going to go right directly into that spot to begin with. I'm going to fish maybe 2 feet out from it and lay those flies in there, make sure I'm getting the right depth and the right drift. Let it swing by, pick it up, maybe lean forward a little bit more. You notice I'm not saying let out more line. I'm just going to lean forward a little bit more. That 9-foot fly rod or 10-foot fly rod comes in real handy right here because now I can lay it in there even closer, maybe a foot closer, reach, drift through there, and do it again. That's how I would approach that from down and below and trying to go inside out.
Okay, good. Well, we covered a lot of material, and I know we could talk for another couple hours, Wayne. Every show has to have its end, and unfortunately it's time for us to wrap this up now. But stick with me because we're going to give away your book here, and I want you to help be the judge and jury on this, and we'll ask a question here shortly. And folks, we'll be giving away in just a few minutes that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and like I just said, a copy of Dwayne's book, Fly Fisher's Playbook. So stick with us here, and maybe you'll be one of the winners. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout weight flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate that. Now, let's see here. We need to get into our database here and do our random drawing for, first of all, the Federation of Fly Fishers membership. And by the way, if you're one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and need to get some information from you so that we can get you these prizes. So, first one, one-year membership, Federation of Fly Fishers. If you're not familiar with the FFF, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, a great organization that's worldwide and supports our efforts in both freshwater and saltwater. And we've got a winner here of Brian Ferdurer in Ohio. So, Brian... And just jotting down his name here, you are the winner of that one-year membership with the Federation of Fly Fishers. So congratulations, Brian. And last name is F-E-R-D-E-R-E-R. So congratulations on winning that prize. Our second winner, which is for the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, is, and that's a great magazine to subscribe to. And if you want to find out more about that, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And the winner there is Gain Bunton, Gain Bunton in Virginia. So, Gain, congratulations there again for winning that.
Now we need to, Dwayne, do something here about giving away your book. So let me just make sure my cue is clear here. Okay. So when we were talking about, and I'm going to make this, let's see if we can make this a little bit difficult. We talked about a searching rig involving two flies down below. What two flies were they, and how were they tied together? Okay? What two flies were they, and how were they tied together? We were talking about a searching pattern and how that rig worked together earlier in the show. So that may take some typing, but did I word that okay, Dwayne?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay, okay. I was trying to make these a little bit difficult. If they're too easy, then people get it too quickly. So I want to make them think a bit here. My gosh, this guy could type fast. Okay, I got to read this to you, and then you can decide if he's got the right answer here or not. He says, tying flies on, tie off the bend of the indicator dry, tie from eye to bend on a stone tumbling, eye to eye for the soft tackle, swimmers, regular clinch knot. If it squeaks when tying, retie, stone fly and may fly nymph. I think he got it, don't you?
Yeah, I think he pretty much pounded that question.
Yeah. So nice. Treg Owens in Moscow, I guess it's Moscow, Idaho, or I probably pronounced that wrong. Don't they pronounce that differently? Not Moscow, but I'm not sure. Anyway, Treg, you won. So, I don't know how in the world you got all that typed out. You must be an excellent typist. That's all I can say. So you won the Fly Fisher's Playbook, and Dwayne will get that out to you. Be sure and send me your address contact information so we can mail that to you. You can send it in the same text box you just typed your answer in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And I'll get that over to Dwayne, and he'll get that book right out to you, and I know you'll enjoy it. I know you'll learn from it. So congratulations, Treg, and good job on that answer. Well, Dwayne, I really appreciate you being on the show again with us tonight. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and we covered a lot of good material, I think. And, boy, folks, if you want more, you know where to get it, Fly Fisher's Playbook. Do you want to give that website address one more time, Dwayne?
Yeah, I will. With pleasure. It's www.flyfishersplaybook.com.
Okay, great. Well, nice having you on the show, Dwayne, and hopefully we can talk again sometime.
Thank you very much, Roger. I appreciate it.
Our next podcast will be on August 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. In that show, we're going to be interviewing Landon Mayer. And our topic for the show is going to be trout hunting Colorado's four seasons. Landon has been on our show before a couple of times, and he's fished Colorado his whole life and has guided across the state for many years. So listen in to this show to find out what the best times to fish in Colorado are and the best places to fish at those times, and we're going to cover quite a bit of ground on that show. So we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, the Orvis Company, Cortland Line, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company might benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website or at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.